Welcome to the Public Astronomy Lecture Series, October edition. Thank you so much for coming. I gave a short course at the Louisville Free Public Library last fall, six lectures, and we had just finished 6 decades of interplanetary spacecraft exploration, so I said, well, that's obvious, I'm going to do a decade per lecture. So this year, I'm cheating a little bit and using one of those lectures. So which is the one? Turns out all that every decade was amazing, and the whole thing worked really well. And so I picked a good decade, but the real reason I have to tell you is my colleague Jerry Villiger came to all of them, except he missed the third one.
Because I was here.
Because you were here for this stuff.
I was giving one of these talks.
You were giving this stuff. Okay, so that was the choice. So that's the background reason why we're doing the third decade, and my colleague Krista was just saying, it doesn't look like a first slide for a talk. Well, it's the first slide for the third lecture of a series. So that's one thing. And then at the very end of this talk, it just ends abruptly because we're at the end of the decade. It gets a tease for the next week, which we're not going to be able to do. And so I just want to warn you that I'll warn you when we're coming. So you want to look for right around October of 1991. So why am I starting kind of the interplanetary spacecraft exploration started in 1962, in the summer of 1962. It just so happens I started in the summer of 1962 in August, and so did Mariner, so did the Mariner 2, the first spacecraft blew up. They had a little thing where they didn't average correctly and it blew up. But the second one came, launched, looked beautiful, and so that's where this started. So we go 62 to 71, 72 to, anyway, so that's what we're going to do. So let me just kind of start by giving you a brief overview of some of the spacecraft that we're going to talk about. So the theme here is unmanned. I do talk about Apollo every now and then, and that's textured past. That was the last couple of decades. This decade of the 80s was amazing. You're going to see it's the agony and the ecstasy, especially for NASA. But it also has Japanese and the Europeans joining in for the first time. So there's a lot going on, a lot of moving parts. So let's go ahead and get started here. You'll notice that some of the highlights of this third decade are the Vega balloons at Venus. This is a contraction of Venus and the Russian word for Halley's Comet, which is they spell it with a G. So as we'll see, the Russians were going to go to Halley's Comet. I don't know if you remember who was around for Halley's Comet in 1986. Yeah, so there was an armada of spacecraft that went, so that's in this decade, so we need to talk about that. So Giotto was the most ambitious of these, and it turned out to have this European Space Agency, their first big mission, to have it be a complete success, which it turned out to be, it had to require the cooperation of an international group. To get within 500 kilometers of the target, they had to have everybody else where they were. The U.S. had to help. Everybody had to help. So that's really cool. And then we had plutonium to do the powering, what's called the RTGs, the radiothermal nuclear generators. The RTGs are basically plugs of plutonium that have an 80-something year half-life and are just hot constantly. If you hold plutonium, it's really hot. And then that heat is turned into electricity to run the spacecraft that we send to the outer solar system. We're actually running out of plutonium, too. It's made here in Kentucky, right? A lot of it. So anyway, they didn't have enough. So instead, they specialized on the inner solar system of particular Venus. This is their decade. Oh, my gosh. The Russians have done things that no one has ever done before. We're going to see some of that. So we'll talk about Venera, which is the Russian name for Venus, and Vega, which is a contraction of Venus and Halley. Halley goes, planetary scientists say Halley. The public tends to say Halley Comet. I'm told that the English family themselves, they say Halley.
So, yeah. So you'll hear me say Uranus, not Uranus.
Yeah.
That's a planetary scientist. That, we just have our ways of saying things. You don't want to say Uranus for 30 years. So anyway, we'll talk about Uranus. And I was a graduate student during the Voyager Uranus encounter, so I actually got to be part of that encounter. So we'll talk about that. Voyager is already encountered Jupiter in 1979 and Saturn in 1981, so just a year before we start here. But we still have Uranus and Neptune both in this decade. And then we have the whole armada of spacecraft that, let me just stand in front of you, that went to Halley's Comet, so that's kind of exciting. Halley's Comet itself in 86 was kind of an end. Right? It's like a smudgy little thing. It wasn't great. So hopefully some of the younger people will see the next one. Okay, and let's see, where am I not going here? There we go. Hubble Space Telescope comes on the radar map. We're going to hear that next month. Jim LaRoche, Professor LaRoche, our colleague, will be talking about greatest hits from Hubble Space Telescope, which is how many, 30-something? Well, it's for here. When it was launched.
1990.
Galileo, like I said. All right, so what I did every week, and this little fun thing, so we're going to go back in time, and we've got to go from today, 2023, down to 1982. So here we go. And the question is, what do we open with? What do we open with this study? We made it to 1982, so now it's 1982, and we have the first color images of the surface, from the surface, of Venus by the Russians. And no one, besides the Russians, has landed on Venus. And no one has sent a picture of that. This is the first color image from the Venus surface. And we have the narrow 14 here. So it's basically front and back. You can put it together. It's basically 360 degrees. And you see, that's the actual color of the sky. It's a pale yellow color. It's a... soil samples, things like that. So really, really good. And no one's ever done it since then. All right, that's how we open up the third decade. And then we have an opportunity. The Russians were going to go, along with the Americans and the Europeans and the Japanese, to Halley's Comet, because we knew Halley's Comet is extremely predictable, and we knew when and where it was going to be. And no one had ever visited a comet before. No one had ever seen the nucleus of a comet. All you see is a brilliantly white tail and a dust tail. But no one had ever seen inside that. They had no idea what the shape would be like, what the color, which we call the albedo, which is how bright or dark it is. Albus Dumbledore, right? Albus, albedo, it just means white. Albus Dumbledore means white. So we'll talk about the albedo. It turns out it was really dark. Okay, so on the way to Halley's Comet, the Russians have to use Venus as a gravity assist. And they decided to take advantage of that because they own Venus. Like I said, they had just landed on Venus, got the color pictures. And so they decided to put balloons for the first time ever into the Venus atmosphere to get in situ measurements, not just of the chemistry, but also the dynamics to actually track the balloons as they go around the planet. Venus has a funny situation where it rotates backwards very slowly. It takes about 243 days, Earth days, to rotate once, which is longer than the year. So just imagine for a minute, where is the sun in the sky on Venus? The day is longer than the year and goes the wrong way. And you couldn't see it anyway because of the clouds. So it's just a crazy, crazy situation.
What do you say wrong?
Everybody's going this way. The planets are going this way, and the planets are spinning this way. Venus is going this way around the sun, but it's spinning with almost no tilt the wrong way. So,
but isn't Uranus also?
Uranus is tipped on its side. We'll see that today in graphic detail. Yeah. So those are the two. If you are very objective and you look at the obliquity of all of the planets in our solar system, the eight planets, I'm a nine planet guy, but the eight planets, It's indistinguishable statistically from random, actually, even though we think of it as all turning like that, because Mars and Earth are very similar, etc. So, okay, so vega balloons. So who do you get to make your balloons if you're going to do scientific investigations with balloons? There's only one answer. And it's been the answer since the beginning of balloon research. The French.
Mm-hmm.
The French.
Chantal.
You do not... Kelvin, this room is about 290 Kelvin. So it's about 500 Kelvin, almost 1,000 degrees hotter than you and I are used to. So if you're, but if you're high up, it's about room temperature, so you get high up. So they go about 54 kilometers. They're traveled westward around the planet. Really fast wind. And so 30% is a lot. Venus is almost exactly the same size as Earth. So you imagine 30%. It kind of reminds me of the Chinese balloons that were going across our country a couple months ago. Both balloons encountered sporadic strong winds. This is the first and only time we've gotten, you know, what we'd say in situ, I mean, you're actually in there, not remote sensing, to actually see the up and down vertical motions, up to 7 mile per hour vertical motions, which is quite dramatic. All right, 1986, an exceptionally busy year. And we have that perspective of all 6 decades last fall. And this year might stand out as the busiest one. It's crazy. So we have Japan and Europe making their very first entries into the Interplanetary Spacecraft Club. They joined the club in 1986. 1986 was full of firsts. The U.S. and the Soviets were the only nations up to this point that had done anything interplanetary. So we had 6 interplanetary spacecraft encounter Alice Comet in 1986, which is pretty impressive. The only thing that's sort of in the background that's not impressive was the U.S. effort was really embarrassing considering our capability for multiple reasons. We did manage to do something, but I don't have a problem with that because the Europeans stepped up and that was their first effort, and it was brilliant. Very, very gutsy and worked well. So NASA, 1986, you'll find, is the year of the agony and the ecstasy. And you know the agony already because you remember Challenger. Okay. So the agony was Challenger was lost. This not only killed the astronauts and lost the space shuttle and put us back a couple of years on all our things, it was just demoralizing. And moreover, it happened during the Uranus encounter, which you recall, I was a grad student working at JPL on the Uranus encounter when this happened. I took a break, about a 2-hour break, and didn't know about this. Came back to campus, and one of my buddies told me as I was just walking around campus that happened. So that is crazy. We lost the space shuttle program was grounded for 2.5 years.
Absolutely devastating. I mean, remember, they were going to fly over 12 missions a year. 2.5 years lost. And Hubble launch was delayed 3.5 years. Gut punch. On the ecstasy side, we have the Voyager Uranus encounter. And I would like to share some of that with you because, like I said, I was a grad student. And, you know, I worked the night shift on that one. That was a lot of fun. So we have, who was it that just said that? We have a 98 degree obliquity. So it's not just tipped on its side, it's actually a little bit past. So the International Astronomical Union has decided that because the pole dips slightly past the average plane, the ecliptic, that we would call it the South Pole, even though it's dynamically the North Pole. So someone like me who does atmospheric dynamics and cares about the Coriolis force and which way the storms turn and which way the planet turns, this is the stupidest thing you could possibly do. So I am required by the IAU to call it the South Pole, but I always start my papers, the IAU South Pole, i.e. dynamically the North Pole. So, oh my God, it's incredibly confusing because west and east are flipped, and oh my God. Anyway, the only planet tipped on its side, it's also the only giant planet or ice giant planet that doesn't have internal heat. So, you know, is that because it got all the fizz knocked out of it? All right, I want to show you something really interesting. Who, as a kid, had a globe and had that funny figure eight on it?
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Did they not make them anymore?
No one's thinking.
All the old people with gray hair said yes. No? Oh, my God. There's one in the hall. My wife just retired, and she had one, and she stuck it out the hall. It's still there. Nobody wants it. I can't believe it. I was fascinated. What the heck is that? I mean, clearly it's not floating in the Pacific, but what you're doing. It's called the analemma. Every planet has one. It's where the sun is at some particular point in the sky every day. So, hey, noon. Where is the sun in the sky at noon every day? And you're not allowed to do daylight savings time because that makes a big glitch in it. So don't do that. So just, where is the sun? If you were to take a picture every day at noon, like set up a camera, which, by the way, is a cottage industry. People do that and sell them for $1,000, like with, you know, Athens, Greece, right in the foreground, and make the analemmas, then you would actually get on Earth that exact figure eight. In fact, I'm going to show you a couple of those figures. So what is it causing this? This sort of y-axis, this up-down part, is controlled by the obliquity, you call it, which is just the tilt, the fancy word for the tilt of the planet. So we're 23.5 degrees. Mars is 24 degrees currently. Jupiter is 3, so Jupiter doesn't really do that. Saturn is 27, so it's kind of Earth-like. Neptune's similar, very Earth-like. And then Venus, of course, is 3 degrees, but upside down, and Uranus is 98 degrees. So we've got all these different things. So that's the obliquity, up-down. What controls the width of this thing? It's the eccentricity of the orbit. So the orbits are slightly egg-shaped, and so they go a little bit faster when they're closer to the sun. They go a little slower when they're farther from the sun. That actually affects that. So if you put those two effects together, the tilt, which is like a seasonal thing, and the orbit, which is also seasonal. It's called the distance season, and you get this figure eight for Earth. Now, you're not going to get a figure eight for every planet. I'm going to show you all the planets, what they're, because Uranus, I think Venus, I didn't plot Venus. Venus, you can't even plot the Venus one, but Uranus is really weird. Okay, so this is actually what I just said. Remember, you take a picture of the sun every noon, or, you know, every once a month, every noon, or once a week. You get that absolutely gorgeous. This is actually a temple of Apollo in ancient Corinth with the analemma. You'll see it tilted depending on what latitude you're at. So that's where the sun is. If you stare at it long enough, you can actually kind of see the outer roundness of our orbit. Because literally the sun's not moving. We are, right? So this is a little trace of our orbit, our slightly out-of-round orbit. These are all of them. So we have a model here in Louisville called the EPIC model, which does atmospheric dynamics for all the planets. And so we actually have this, and what's called the equation of time here is on the x-axis, and what's called the declination of the sun is on the y-axis, which is the same thing you get if you look in the sky like that. And there's Earth, the beautiful figure eight that you'll see in any globe. And then you'll see Mars, it doesn't make the figure eight, right? It makes this sort of teardrop shape. It doesn't quite have that loop around the outside. And then Jupiter doesn't have any seasons, so it's 3 degrees, so it just barely has a nudge in that direction, and almost circular orbit. If you had a perfectly circular orbit and no tilt, you'd have a dot, right? So that little figure that you're making is from those two effects. Saturn is this, it's kind of like Mars, it's trying to make a figure eight, but not quite like that. And then, let me skip Uranus. Neptune is gorgeous, absolutely symmetric, perfect figure eight, beautiful Neptune. And you can see, you just read the obliquity off by the by, see the 23, well, it's marked at 30 here, but 20 is right about there. So 23 to minus 23, you can see that. So this here is the obliquity, and you can see it's a little bit larger, and the Neptune's tilted a little bit more this way, and it has almost beautifully circular orbit. And then we have Uranus, which, like you said, is tilted. So if you do the math, the North Pole and the South Pole get more sunlight on average in a year than the equator does. It's just weird. So it's really weird. So at the time of Voyager, we had one of the poles in darkness and one of the poles in sunlight. And so we basically only got to see half of everything. There is a big opportunity in 10 years. Jupiter right now is in the right place in the next 10 years for us to get to Uranus quickly. So the big hot thing right now for planning is what's called a Uranus orbiter and probe, UOP, the UOP, which doesn't have a name yet. So that, you'll hear that in the news a lot, like we're having lots and lots. We're going to have a workshop here in Louisville, actually, next November, November of next year, called Exoplanets in Your Backyard. And Uranus and Neptune happen to be the class of planets that's very common in all the exoplanets that are being discovered. So we're going to have people from all over the world here at the Muhammad Ali Center down in November of next year. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Let's do it. Let's go ahead and I'm going to set up Uranus, and then we're going to watch the sort of computer graphics of the sequencing that we use to go through the because it's the planet, the rings, the magnetic field, and also the satellites. You want to do all of that, and you have one pass with Voyager question.
Why isn't that figure eight for your metric for Earth?
Oh, for Earth?
Yeah.
Well,
why is it so lumpy at the bottom and skinny at the
top? Because we have a fairly eccentric orbit. So we go really fast through the part where we're close to the Earth,
uh-huh.
and we take a long time, and that makes it droopy on one side and droopy on the other side. So the ones that weren't like that, for Neptune, they're very circular orbit. So they spend about the same amount of time every point in their orbit, so they end up with a nice, pretty.
Thank you.
Okay, so I want to walk you through let's set up the Uranus encounter. There's a lot of. I got to see some of this because I was a grad student at Caltech at this time, 1986. There's a lot of discipline. This is the engineer's haven, right? The scientists are a small part. The engineers are a huge part of this and to make everything work. And so they have some really strict rules. So remember, this is the third planet that they've encountered. And the Voyager mission was made out of Mariner parts. So it was high-tech at the time, but it was launched in 1977. So this is 10-year-old technology, which is already about 5 or 10 years old before it launches. So we're talking pretty old stuff. Your phone on your camera is thousands of times better. The memory in your phone is millions of times larger than the memory on Voyager. Voyager's still going, by the way. Okay, so software to development freeze. Absolute. It's incredible. I'm a software developer. They stop it. The managers come in with the unbelievable. They just stop. You cannot change the software. It has a bug. It has a 3. You can't change it. They just stop it. The discipline works. They've proven over the decades that this works. But it is brutal, especially if and it's fine. They just freeze it.
Why?
Because they have to have assurance that it's going to work. So you work around that bug. If you fix that bug, you may screw something else up.
Right.
I can't do that. When you come within a couple months of a mission like this, oh, my God. And this mission, you know, launched in 77, 86, 11 years, and that's with this really benevolent alignment of Jupiter and Saturn being fit there. Increased security at JPL. We were working for a couple of weeks before the encounter, just walk in, walk out with a simple, you know, I'm a student, Caltech student, my advisor's on the team, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, guards show up all over the place. The police are everywhere, and you have to have a badge. That's my badge. That got me into flight system operations, access operation. There's a contingency plan like you wouldn't believe. I mean, you're talking planetary science, JPL. They plan for things that can't even happen. They plan for everything. And, of course, they don't get everything. Things happen that just nobody even thinks of. But they think of what you can think of, what other people can think of, what has happened, what could happen. They just, contingency planning is amazing. They stay focused. Your only option, you can't put the brakes on. You can't change the orbits. You are going through the thread that you figured out months to years ago. You're going through that, and you're going through it at the time it's going to happen. I mean, there is no option. You have to be focused. And then this happened.
Challenge.
During the week of the Boyd encounter. January 28, 1986, Challenger disaster. 73 seconds after launch during the Boyd 2 Uranus encounter, Challenger blew up. All right. Wow. Well, it's going to happen anyway. So this is the sequence. Anybody recognize the music? Pulse, the planet? Of course. The Uranus rings are called the star system of Sagittari. So there's a lot of occultations. Sometimes it's the sun seen from Voyager. Sometimes it's Voyager being occulted, seen from Earth. Oberon? Anybody figure out the theme for the names?
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare's what play?
Midsummer Night's Dream.
That's right.
Sorry.
So before they come up, name some more characters from that play. Yeah. We'll see them all here. Can you feel the relentlessness of this orbit? And the planet. Every single motion. Turning the tape recorder on and off has to be planned because it shakes the cameras. Everything has to be planned. Gabriel? As we get closer, we're going to get more than one photograph on inner satellites.
Many moons says that Venus had, or Neptune.
Maybe 28, 29.
This is called a far encounter. It's a little bit more relaxed, a little bit, but they still have the cops everywhere. Now we're getting into the near encounter. And you can see Uranus is clearly tilted funny.
Those real colors?
Yes, but these are actually far encounter images, so the actual images that we got are much better than this computer graphic. I'll show you a close-up of the best Miranda, which is this amazing moon that we're about to encounter in a minute here. So it's all about the satellites, and then it becomes all about the magnetic field, and then it becomes the atmosphere, and then whoosh, you go across the other side, and there's occultations like crazy. The most important one, I think, is that when the spacecraft is attenuated by the atmosphere, because it's very accurate. Here we are. We're actually past the planet now. We're going to look back at Earth and the Sun. They're right next to each other. All right, you see the Sun come into view, and you can just imagine the Earth is very close to it. All of those occultations are used, every single one of them. All the ring occultations. And then we get a very important atmosphere ingress, and then we get an egress. The egress is very tough because you've got to predict where to point to catch the signal, and you don't know where it's going to come out exactly. Because they have to be very precise. And they did a really good job of it. There it is, that's the egress. From both the ingress and egress, you get the vertical structure of the atmosphere. And then you get all the ring structure again. And now that's it, and you're on to Neptune, which took just 3 years. We went 1986 to 1989 was the Neptune encounter. And the Voyager 2, I think as you guys are aware, are still operating.
What's it doing right now?
I'll show you. This is what's called the 30-day report. So, in addition to all that security and all that engineering and stuff, there's a lot of contracts because when things actually happen on time, it's always because it's a contract. So, when the scientists sign up to be on the team, they have a contract that they have to have a 30-day report. And so, this is the Brad Smith was the head of the imaging team. So, each of the teams, imaging, radio, magnetic field, they have to have a 30-day report and a 90-day report. In practice, what happened was the 30-day report kind of came out after 4 or 5 months, and the 90-day report came out about a year. But, I mean, they have. We have the very good report. So this is the Smith et al. 30-day report, and there's me right there. Mm-hmm.
What's the E stand for?
Pardon?
What's the E stand for?
What's the E?
E-Gallon.
Oh, Edward.
Edward. I was going to say.
Okay, so one of my favorite stories, Jerry's is exhibit for the stories. So I was a graduate student. I was working literally the night shift. So it started about midnight and ended about 8 in the morning. And it was all CRTs, just regular old-fashioned TVs that are all up here. And so the images come down raw, and they have the little, what are called the Rizzo marks, little black marks on them, because this was a Vidicon. It was actually open the shutter, and you expose an electronic plate, and then you just ran a electronic beam across it. Called a Vidicon. There was no CCDs. It launched in 1977. So, I mean, it worked, but the problem was with little voltage glitches, you get the figure can come out around. And you can see that with the Apollo mission, too. They have these little black marks, these little burn marks. Well, they basically try to remove those to show the public, but those are in there. Those images come down on the TVs, or they're coming down on the workstations, 1986 workstations. And so I was working on the atmosphere, and Uranus was pretty much a dud with the pole and the sun, and it just, all the other planets were better than me. I got the dud. But anyway, we found a couple of, I personally found the first cloud on Uranus in history, so that was cool. But we had like 3 clouds with about 8 people to work on them, so that was pretty bad. But next door was it was John Spencer and that group. He was working the night shift. And they were doing the satellites, and down comes the images of Miranda. This is the little tiny moon. Look at that. It looks like ice cream, right? It looks like it's sort of the old, boring crater gray stuff up here, but what the heck is going on here? And look at that. So I hear in the next room, I'm going to say it. He said, Jim, what? Come here. Come see this God Almighty clip. So I was the second person in the world to ever see this. This is the clip on Miranda. It's a scissor fall. And see if I can get it to come up here. There it is. This is John Spencer's God Almighty clip. That's a vertical scissor fall. And it takes about, 46 seconds to fall, to jump. You just go and go and go. Very, very nice. Just sort of fall forever.
Well, how far above the surface is it?
About 24 inches. So compare,
Why doesn't it get sucked down on that?
Perfectly, perfectly vertical. It's the most sheer vertical cliff in the whole solar system ever been discovered. It's just a great big curved pile. So the smaller you are, the bigger your mountains can be. Is that intuitive or counterintuitive? Yeah, because Mars is smaller than us and has bigger mountains than us because structurally you don't have to fight as much gravity. So Miranda is actually quite small. It's big enough to be round, I'll branch it out, but it's very small. Clearly, it has to just bust it apart and reformed at least once, maybe twice. And then you get this huge God Almighty cliff. Really exciting. So this is now kind of just to give you the full picture. This was Uranus during Voyager. You can see that's what I was dealing with. I did clouds and gray red spot. My car right up there, GRS1, gray red spot 1, is my license plate. My wife says GRS2, she's a mathematician, says, why do I have GRS2 on my car? I said, because I set them up. Anyway, so there's no gray red spot on Uranus. It turns out there was one on Neptune, so 3 years later, got it again. But anyway, that's in 1986. But in 2012, using ground-based technology, using what's called adaptive optics, which was actually developed by the military. This is a sort of a spears into plowshares type thing. It's sort of turning a military application into a civilian application. They get this incredible, incredible details. Look at this. It almost looks like a birthday cake here. And all kinds of stuff.
Great.
Clouds all over the place. It's just seasonal. Very seasonal. These happen to be here during sort of the peak of the summer haze season. Is what happened to me. But in 2012, it's an 80-some year, so you need about 20-some years of, you know, 2.5 decades to, so it lasts, a year on Uranus is like a healthy year for your human lifetime, right? Mid-80s. So this is what's happening in 2012, and then this is 2018, Hubble Space Telescope. You can see a polar hood forming again, and a lot of features. So we just got a dull season there, but it's a very active, very, very fascinating planet, and it will be, we think, the next flagship. We've got this 10-year window, and NASA never misses an opportunity like that. So we'll get a Uranus orbiter, the first orbiter. Uranus and Neptune are called ice giants because they actually, it's not that they're cold, but it's that they have a lot of water, like a lot of water, huge amount of water, and other what are called volatiles, like methane and ammonia, a lot more than Jupiter and Saturn, which are almost all hydrogen. That's exciting. Okay, Voyager 2 in 1986 made the discovery of a ring on Uranus that we hadn't seen from the ground. The rings of Uranus were discovered by Jim Elliott. He was two doors down from me when I was an assistant professor at MIT, and he discovered them by accident. He used to do all of his occultations, and so they used to fly an airplane that specifically gets above the water vapor of Earth, gets up in the stratosphere. It's basically a telescope on an airplane. And so they do it all the time. So he used that for occultations and was doing the atmosphere of Uranus. Like I said, the ingress and egress, you can do that. Every time you know Uranus is going to go in front of the star, you can do that. So that was his career. He did that for everything. They would plan them and all that. And so they watched Uranus, hadn't done Uranus before. They had this good, bright star. They were excited. But before the star touched the limb, which is the edge of the planet, it blinked. And they got, the electronics are glitching. And it blinked again. What are you doing? It's again, the occultation is going to happen, right? It's nothing you can do to stop it. Blink, blink, and blink, blink. And then it stopped, everything stabilized, and they got the ingress. Then they had to calculate, they pre-calculated where the egress would be, and they got that. They got the egress. And then shortly after that, blink, 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 blink again, and they looked at it. It was a mirror image of the first one, and he had just discovered the rings of Uranus. We had no idea that they were there. So Voyager actually added to that catalog with this little ring. Now, this is a really faint ring. See that right there? They named all the rings, there's a Greek letter, things like that. So the Uranus Zeta ring, and it was only a single Voyager image. And so we lost that ring and had trouble, couldn't find it in any, because we won't have one close encounter with Uranus, just Voyager 2. Voyager 1, because it went to Titan, went off the Grand Tour and couldn't go to Uranus. Had Voyager 1 failed at Titan, they were going to put Voyager 2 on the Titan mission and lose Uranus and Neptune. So it's all linked. Because Voyager 1 was successful at Titan, we got the outer solar system. All right. Not in 2007, that's 20 years, two decades after the Zeta ring was finally recovered by Keck. We just heard about Keck. That's one of our bigger ground-based telescopes. Here it is. It was found actually by a citizen scientist, like somebody in this room, and a name of Ian Regan. And there it is. And he got it by stacking images from Voyager 2 that hadn't been done yet. They just didn't do it. He stacked them like crazy. He was very patient and recovered the Zeta ring. So that was really cool. It's changing on a decadal time scale, which is exciting. One of the big discoveries for Cassini, which is after this decade, is the Cassini is in orbit around Saturn for 13 years, and maybe probably the best flagship we've ever flown, is that the rings of Saturn are remarkably young. Sharks are older than the rings of Saturn. So right around the time of the big Cretaceous Tertiary dinosaur event, it's about when the rings of Uranus of Saturn formed, they're geologically relatively young. So my question is, what did we go through? What did the solar system go through? Smash up an icy moon and make the ring Saturn about the same time the dinosaurs died. Was that a really like bad week or something? Literally could happen at the same time. All right, so this was given to me, one of the people who came to the talk like a week before. That was kind of cool. All right, let's switch now. We're still in 1986, this amazingly busy year. We're in March. We're only in the third month of 1986. And we have this armada encountering Halley. So basically, the most ambitious mission was Giotto. But in order for Giotto to work, you had to have everybody else. So I'm going to go from far to near. Okay? And so we're going to start with NASA. NASA just dropped the ball. Oh, my God. People are still upset. We just didn't get our act together. It's just, we did everything else good, but not Collins Comet. But anyway, we did manage to take an old satellite that had repurposed it, renamed it, repurposed. This is a satellite for other purposes, repurposed, sent to be on the mission, and it just caught the outer edge of Halley's Comet, just barely nipped it. So, but at least we got something. So that was the hardest one. And then we had the Japanese entering the club, joining the club. Interplanetary spacecraft was U.S., Russia, and that was it. And the Russians kicked our butt on the moon for a while, and then we caught up. You guys know that story. And then the Russians clearly owned Venus. We owned Mars, basically. And then we started owning the outer solar system. Then the Japanese, in this third decade, joined with two great twin spacecraft, and they were a little closer than us. So they had, you're supposed to pronounce the consonant and the vowel and then stop. So it's Saki Gake and Susei of Japan. And then we had the combined Venus balloon and Halley's Comet mission, Vega 1 and Vega 2, by the Soviet Union. And then we had Giotto. Now, Giotto is trying to fly through the coma and image the nucleus, which is the actual icy rock that all this stuff is coming off of, right? Very dangerous place to be. All right, so in order to get that to happen, you had to have cooperation, and they named it. It's called the Pathfinder mission. Now, NASA had another mission called Pathfinder, which is a Mars mission that happens like a decade after this. So don't confuse those two. It's completely different things. This is the Pathfinder project to get Giotto to succeed. And so it's a first-rate example of international collaboration. It really was. We're talking about different languages, different units, different everything. They got it all to work. Telescopes could only steer, this is ground-based telescopes, this is before Hubble. Hubble's this decade, but it's not up yet. Telescopes could only steer Giotto to within about 1,500 kilometers, but the goal was one-third that. So you needed something better than ground-based. The Pathfinder goal was to direct Giotto to within 500 kilometers of Halley to get real. They want to see if there are craters on a comet. They want to see the nucleus. No one had ever seen the nucleus of a comet ever. The twin Soviet Vega spacecraft encountered Halley the week before Giotto by design, and they were able to say exactly where is the comet and where exactly is Giotto, and the people that are the best at that are the U.S. What's called the Deep Space Network. We'll talk about that in detail. You guys have, there's an app, there's a website. I want you to look it up either right now or when I get to it or later today. It's eyes on the solar system. Amazing. So we have the Deep Space Network. It's just really, really accurate. So the U.S. Very Long Baseline Interferometry System tracks Vega, so we know exactly where the Russian spacecrafts are, to within, like, the size of this pub, like, incredibly accurate. And then Vega, we know where Vega is, and Vega knows where it is relative to the comet, so we could actually tell Giotto exactly where to go. And they were tweaking Giotto with all this information. And so Giotto successfully encountered Halley. It was a little outside, but still, I mean, come on, 596 kilometers. Really, really successful. Couldn't come anywhere close to that without this. So that worked really well. And there's what it does say. This is March 14, 1986. Is Giotto image of the nucleus of Halley's Comet. You've seen it probably in the history books. When it first came down in March, that was the first image ever of... I can't remember. It actually came down. Does anyone remember? Do you remember? It came down and they pseudo-colored it. So it kind of had colors. They wanted it to look pretty for the press. And unfortunately, it saturated a little bit. It's a little, they didn't have the shutter quite right. So anyway, it was just came out all these colorful stripes. And Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister, and she's sitting there, and they spent all this money. And this is the first mission. This is their first big interplanetary. This is very expensive, right? So she's looking at it, and she stands up. She says, "That's a complete crock. What a waste of money." And she storms out of here. And then the next day, they got the black and white, which looks like that. Oh, my God. She missed that. I hope they showed it to her later. So you see two jets, you see all this stuff coming out, the sun is on this side here, You can see, actually, when you look at the image, you see craters, stuff like this. And what you see, what is the color when you get down inside that coma, away from all that bright gas that the sun is, you know, sliding up? When you get down into the actual peanut, the actual thing, what color is that? It's this color. It's the darkest object in the solar system. It has an albedo of 3%. And that was stunning. It means the comets are not the size we thought, because you've got to figure out, if, you know, are you far away and bright, or are you nearby and dark? Those are just, they look the same, right? So you have to know the albedo. 3%. It's about 15 kilometers by about 8 kilometers. It's big. And its albedo is 3%. It's the darkest known object in the solar system. We have now since then imaged several comets. We've orbited comets. We've landed on comets now in the last couple of decades. And they're all in that 3 to 5%. But Alice Comet was the first object you've ever seen that's up there. Uranus and Neptune have really dark satellites and really dark, basically, it's like very damaged hydrocarbons. It's like charred black. But even the black of your charcoal, of your grill, is brighter than this. Even the charcoal black is more like 6%. This is really dark. So that was amazing. Giotto's multicolor camera actually failed. Remember, they go into the dust really close to this thing. This thing is 15 kilometers, and they're only 590 away. So they're just, you know, an order of magnitude away from the thing, really close. So the Giotto multicolor camera optical path got blocked by a spray light baffle that's around the outside of the camera to keep spray light from bouncing into the camera. It's just a little shield. It got hit, and it got jammed into the camera. It was smashed by dust, and that happened a few seconds after this picture was taken.
Oh.
Big explosion out there, right?
At least they got this one.
Yeah, well, they got it, and then they got it, and then that was it. So, very gutsy, and it was successful. Some of the Challenger fallout, we had the shuttle mission grounded. In October 1986 was the planned launch of Hubble Space Telescope. Do you remember that? Yeah, it affected all these astronomers who they use Hubble. It affected them. So that was supposed to happen in this busy year, and it had been canceled. There it is. 3.5 years, it just sat right here in this clean room. Very expensive. NASA and the European Space Agency did not waste it. You always turn a crisis into an opportunity, right? So you've got all this extra time. It's very frustrating, but now you can rethink things. You can look at your software and your hardware, and you can fix it before you launch it, because it's very hard to fix after you launch it. They did, and it was brilliant. They made lots of improvements. They improved the solar panels. They improved the batteries. They improved the mission software. Remember that lock I told you about? It comes undone at 3.5 years. And they improved the in-orbit repair tools. And all four of these turned out to reduce the problems that they could have had. And so Hubble has been, other than the fact that they had to have a correction to us.
It's too bad they didn't catch that.
That was bad. But other than that, and the delay from the launch vehicle that they're going to use, this was a good thing. So this actually made the Hubble that we know and love today, that you'll hear about in detail next month, is what it is, in part because of these improvements. Okay, so these significantly reduce future mission issues. All right, so we got Uranus encounter. Now we're off to Neptune to get the grand tour. And so it was only 3 years, because you can imagine the Voyager 2 is going really fast by this point, having passed by three giant planets. So I want to just give you one story about Neptune. Neptune is an amazing system. But it has storms, clear storms. It has something that was just like the Great Red Spot. It's called the Great Dark Spot. Had another storm called Oval D2. Had a scooter. Here you see all these things. Clouds like crazy. The clouds you see, it's blue, but it's not blue like our blue sky. It's blue because of methane absorbing all the red light. And the white clouds, they're not clouds like our water clouds. They're methane clouds. So natural gas is the white cloud that you see. You see shadows of the methane clouds on the blue cloud deck. So gorgeous, gorgeous. And very visceral, right? Blue sky, white clouds. That's sort of where we're bred for that. But I want you to think about storms. So we have this constraint, like you saw with Uranus. I played that thing, that long thing. Of course, it's sped up from what really happened. But the inevitability of the orbit, right, of the encounter. You just got to go with what's going to happen. You've got to plan ahead of time. You can't do anything else. So the cameras were two cameras. They were four-sided. There was a wide-angle camera and a narrow-angle camera. And the narrow-angle camera is the one that gives you the sweet high-resolution stuff. And it's lined up perfectly with the wide-angle camera, right? So you have to tell the engineers, the scientists have to tell the engineers what they want to take a picture of 2 weeks before they take the picture. Because they have to clear it through the software quality assurance. They have to upload it all the way to Uranus. They have to test it once it gets there. So they have that very strict rule. You have to do a weather forecast. So we're doing the storms, the weather on Neptune, a 2 week weather forecast to get the bullseye of the inside of these little hurricanes on Neptune, right? I want you to compare that. We just happen to have a big, fat hurricane on Earth the same summer as this encounter called Hugo.
Mm.
It's a name. It's one of the ones with the names been retired because it was a nasty one. Okay, so you've got Hurricane Hugo on Earth, and you've got the Great Dark Spot, which was unexpected, that was discovered during what's called the Far Encounter Sequence. You've got the old meteor, you've got Scooter, you've got all these cool things on Neptune. You want to get them dead center with the small narrow-angle camera, right? 2 weeks to predict where and when and how long the shutter's open and exactly where it's going to point. Literally, if you're off by a little bit, you don't even get the storm. Okay, so you got to do a very precise 2 week forecast. Meanwhile, the Earth terrestrial meteorologists are trying to basically save people's lives and say, where's Hugo going to come on the land? These are happening at the same time. It's a perfect comparison. Okay, so September 1989, Voyager 2 has just encountered Neptune. Back on Earth, Hugo has become a hurricane. This is Hurricane Hugo. It's Florida. This is Carolinas, North Carolina, South Carolina. The terrestrial meteorologists are trying to predict the path of Hurricane Hugo 12 hours in advance, which is usually enough time to tell people that haven't left yet to get out of the way. So we're trying to make a one-half day or 12-hour weather forecast. A month earlier, Voyager scientists, Andy Musso, my advisor, Rita Beattie, all of those grads and all of those people, had sat around and had figured out what they wanted. They had uploaded 14-day, which is 336-hour predictions of the locations of the Great Dark Spot, the Obelisk 2, the Scooter, for the narrow-angle camera sequencing. So compare that, 336-hour prediction versus a 12-hour prediction, basically trying to get, for example, images of the eye of the storm. Savannah, Georgia was evacuated because of the 12-hour weather forecast. Savannah, Georgia is now a ghost town. It got lime rain. It's a little bigger than the eye in terms of storm size. You'll see some of the close-ups. So Hugo did hit Savannah. Didn't even get the state right. They didn't even get the state right. It hit Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. As you know, you've probably seen it before and after. So some of the coastline restaurants that were wiped out are still wiped out. So that was a disaster. Voyager, on the other hand, took close-up or bullseye after bullseye after bullseye. So what you take from this is the weather on the gas giants on Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune is much more predictable than the weather on Earth. So this is the Great Dark Spot. Here's Dark Spot 2. They would have went way over here. I mean, they didn't get the state right. Perfect bullseye. Perfect. These are the cloud shadows of the methane clouds. You can get the height of the clouds and things like that from Neptune, which is exciting. So Neptune was amazing. In addition to the atmosphere and the magnetic field, you also have the satellites. And I want to draw your attention to one satellite of Neptune called Triton. It's extremely large for a satellite, and it's going the wrong way. Who was bothered when I said the wrong way? But yeah, it's going the wrong way. Everything's going this way. The Neptune's spinning just like all the other planets. And then Triton's going the wrong way, what we call a retrograde orbit. It's kind of a weird, loopy retrograde orbit. And Triton, for all intents and purposes, looks a lot like Pluto. So we think it's just another Pluto that was captured by Neptune. So it orbits Neptune backwards. It's captured by another planet, another Pluto. And it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Look at that. It's got, this is called cantaloupe terrain for obvious reasons. It's got all this smear stuff here, some stuff here. It's not quite as crazy as Miranda. A lot of ice here. Just the people who do icy satellite surfaces just love this. And there's what's called cryovolcanism, so ice volcanism. And you have, interestingly, at different pressures, you go into these. These are large rooms. You have really high pressure. ice actually forms different phases. You know, all that stuff you learn in chemistry, the closest packed stuff, the different phases, the hexagonal, and all of that. It forms different phases, and you actually have triple points. You and I know about, like, from chemistry, know, like, liquid, solid, gas, triple point for water. But there's actually a triple point for all those ice phases, too. It's really, really fascinating stuff. And some of the ice phases are different densities. So you have buoyancy, and you have pyrovolcanism. Fascinating little thing. But I want to draw your attention to these little spheres right here, because those are not ice. Those are actual, well, first of all, the surface is 38 Kelvin minus 391 Fahrenheit. And this is this close up. Look at that. A little shadow. That's a geyser on a 38 Kelvin surface. That far away from the sun. An active Yosemite old faithful geyser shooting up like this. It's about 5 miles high. It's about 100 miles long. It has a shadow. It changes with time. You have a little movie of it. There is the what the heck? What?
Is that water ice?
No, well, there's a lot of water ice. It's, yeah, I think it might be powered by ammonia. So different volatilities. Whatever's the most volatile is the thing that sort of gives it the thing to it. So active geysers on this thing. And now we know all these ices have, it's actually a liquid, briny oceans on the inside. Liquid, room temperature, briny oceans with hydrogen profile and tidal forces for energy and everything happening. So our habitable zone, just in the last 20 years, has gone to all these ices out. That's really crazy.
I'm not seeing you guys.
Okay, so this thing. That's the geyser, and this is the tail coming off of it. This is a little bit later. This
okay.
is the shadow of the shale of the geyser.
Okay.
Yeah. Great question. So that's really cool. It's, think of it as like a choo-choo, right? So a locomotive, a steam locomotive. It has this flow kind of goes up, so it's reaching what's called a level of neutral buoyancy. So basically you got a hot steam coming up, and it just sort of wants, if it was just a chimney, it would sort of go up like that. But it's moving, right? So it goes up, and then it gets sheared. So it's feeding this guy, and then it's feeding that. So there's a wind. So we get the wind. Oh, my God. So that was stunningly unexpected. Stunningly unexpected. So on one of the farthest, coldest objects there is. Okay, water voyage one, voyage two. I'm going to grant you this is from last year, but it's about the same. So last year, this in October, Voyager 1 was 21 hours and 57 minutes. So now it's off just about 22 hours light travel time. That's one way. So when NASA talks to Voyager 1, it takes 22 hours to signal to reach Voyager 1. Then Voyager 1 processes it and responds. It takes another 20 hours. So it's crazy. Voyager 2 is about 18 hours. The plutonium plug that is keeping Uranus, keeping Voyager warm so it doesn't freeze. And remember, that's an 80, what is it, 80-some year. Yeah, and then this thing was launched in 77. The plutonium was a little bit older than that when they put it in there. So how many decades are we talking about? It's more than half of its half-life, right? So it's way down. So they're running on 23 watts right now. 23 watts! This is... That's... Yeah, 23 watts to talk to this thing. So we need the deep space network, the big antennas, the 70-meter antennas. So what I wanted you to learn, one of your takeaways from today's lecture is I want you to either write now on your phone or at some point look at eyes.nasa.gov. You'll see a whole bunch of apps, and down towards the bottom you're going to see the deep space network. And you can see what the deep space network is looking at right now. There's three of them every 8 hours around Earth. There's one in Spain, there's one in California, and there's one in Australia. Exactly. So we always have a deep space network antenna under wherever our spacecraft are. And so eyes.nasa.gov, that's the only thing you need to take from this talk. It is amazing to see that. After this talk, I'll bring it up. Yesterday on the phone, because I don't have a Wi-Fi.
Wow.
So this is what the big antennas look like. Really impressive. So you want to look, when you go to eyes.nasa.gov, look for DSN Now. And you'll see that what the Deep Space Network is literally talking to right now, as you see. The Deep Space Network is how our robotic explorers keep in touch. And you can see which spacecraft are talking to us right now in that live web app. Really cool. All right, so we're in 1990, so we're a couple years. Remember, we only go to 1991 for this talk. So we're April 25, 1990. Discovery deploys. Discovery's space shuttle deploys the Hubble Space Telescope. 3.5 years later than originally planned. There it is. With the arm. And that's all I'm going to say about Hubble, actually. Galileo is now on its way to Jupiter. That's the orbiter for Jupiter. And it used what's called a Venus-Earth-Earth gravity assist. I'm going to play this again. Let's see if I can back this up.
Were all the, are the Voyagers using planetary boosts to get to steer, or are they little jets on them?
For which spacecraft?
For the Voyagers. How do they aim?
So you have two options. But you have the rocket to get you off of Earth,
right.
And then you use the gravity assists to get a huge, it's called a delta V, but a
right.
huge momentum boost. And then to do the tweaking, you have these hydrazine tanks.
Okay.
So you don't want to use those too much because you don't want to run out of those. The mission's over after you run out of the hydrazine. So you want to do as much as you can. And the more you can plan for a gravity assist, the less fuel you have to take with you. Fuel's very heavy. So that's why they want to do that. So let me go. So you're going to see a Venus Earth-Earth gravity assist. And so this is the launch right here. There's the Venus Earth, and there's the second Venus one. And then, so this purple thing is Galileo on its way to Jupiter. And finally, there's the other one. And then there's Jupiter out here. So we're just look at the timing of that. And that's orbit insertion, Jupiter orbit insertion, and then just orbit Jupiter to us that. So that's the good news. That worked out great. We got to our first orbiter to Jupiter. Because remember, Voyager was a flyby, not an orbiter. Okay. What does Earth look like? We had an Earth. So we have a spacecraft, an interplanetary spacecraft encountering Earth. So can we detect life on Earth?
Yeah.
This is actual images from Galileo, the Galileo solid-state imaging camera. This is what Earth looks like. Of course, it's been Earth changes in size every few seconds, right, as we're flying by, so they regularize that. You can see the little shine of the sun there. The question was, scientific question, could you detect and prove that there's life of any kind? And the second question, can you prove or detect intelligence? Any evidence at all for intelligent life on Earth? All right, let's get to that. What evidence for intelligent life on Earth did Galileo detect? We have the solid-state imaging system that we're using as the good camera. By then, they finally had CCDs. We had a system that gave us 2 kilometer resolution. So every pixel is 2 kilometers. But with that resolution, there was no geometric evidence detected. Even when Melbourne and Adelaide were photographed, two big cities in Australia. Only one image out of the entire sequence taken by Galileo as it encountered Earth, as the border between South Australia and Victoria, showed east-west and north-south markings that would raise suspicions of intelligent activity. That was the only image from the images. So the conclusion there is it takes nearly complete mapping at 1/10, not 2, 1/10 kilometer resolution to obtain convincing photographic evidence of an advanced civilization. This is the kind of lessons we have to learn for exoplanets as we try to find astrobiology somewhere else. It's extremely difficult to image it. Yeah, you could, but at 2 kilometer resolution.
Doesn't matter, it comes to light.
Well, we do have evidence from Galileo of intelligent life. It's basically the radio. It's the eye level CCD. We have a plasma wave spectrometer, PWS. It had detected emissions increasing rapidly as we approached this planet, Earth, proving that the source of the emissions was Earth itself. Emissions were detected on the night side only, which suggests that the source is below the ionosphere, so it puts it on the surface mostly, and there were complicated modulations in the signal. We're talking on the radio. So that was emissions translating information into what we call non-thermal. So that's what we're constantly looking for, any non-thermal emissions at all. So we did get that. We did get that. All right, the agony and the ecstasy continues, and I'm towards the end. Remember, we're going to end in this year, so we're at the last year of the decade now. April 1991, We have this gorgeous orbiter going to Jupiter called Galileo. Galileo high gain antenna fails to deploy.
Mm.
And it's related to the shuttle disaster. One disaster causing another disaster. Let me show you that. So this is what it actually ended up looking like. This is the, these are the ribs 9, 10, 11. So they designed it like an umbrella. It was supposed to open up. And then never, ever lose that again. Ever. Just, you know. So this is what the artist's rendition of it looks like. So the high-gain antenna, here's why it happened. So because of the challenge of disaster, the Galileo was in storage for 4.5 years. It had to make 3 cross-country trips. They would be in the news, like for one day, you'd see them in the paper, and then you won't worry about it again. But it's a big deal for NASA. 3 cross-country trips by truck, back and forth, during this period. Antenna lubricants were applied once to the Galileo antenna, 10 years before launch. And the high-gain antenna was supposed to be 134,000 bits per second, 134 kilobits per second. Doesn't sound like a lot today, but for a telescope, I mean, for a spacecraft, it's gorgeous. It would have been great. It affects me because that's atmospheric dynamics, all the atmospheric dynamics. So what are the workarounds? The engineers just go for it. First of all, there was a Tiger team put together to try to fix it. They jeered like that. And they just never could. They just had the same kind of heart attack with the Europeans going to one of the satellite missions where it got stuck. They got a loose object a few months ago. So this still happens. It's like, you have lots of moving parts. I mean, James Webb Space Telescope shouldn't work, right?
Right.
Seen that?
Something.
All those moving parts, and it worked flawlessly. It's really difficult job. But anyway, one of the workarounds here, we have the low-gain antenna. So they have this little foil. Like an afterthought little coil. It doesn't even focus, doesn't even have an antenna. Low gain antenna increased from 16 bits per second, look at the difference between that, to 160 bits per second by upgrading the Deep Space Network. In other words, a listening device on the ground, you can put millions of dollars into that and make it listen better. So you go, that's a lot. That is an order of magnitude improvement, 16 to 160. And then they increased the data rate, but they could send the data down to Earth at. And this is really amazing, from 160 to 1,000 bits per second by doing sophisticated data compression. They had to invent and borrow and adapt huge sophisticated data compression for the time. I mean, you know, just that's how they did it. So I remember it was lossy, too, and that's really controversial, right? To throw away data so they can get it. But a fantastic job. So they actually were able to get a whopping 70% of all the science schools, 70% from without a high data. Really impressive. 70% of the original science subjects are doing that. All right, the last thing we're going to talk about, and then this talk just sort of abruptly ends, is October 29th, 1991. This is the just same October as right now, so November, December, and then we're done with this third decade. Galileo did encounter the asteroid Gasper. There's a really close encounter with Gasper. You can see it kind of has the same shape as Halley's Comet, but it's rocky. And it's big. It's 19 kilometers by 12 by 11, and we're about 5,300 kilometers away from that. So, in the decades to follow, we start landing on these asteroids and all kinds of crazy things. That was pretty neat at the time. This particular piece of rock here orbits about 2.21 astronomical units, and almost 2.21 times the Earth orbit. It's in the inner edge of the asteroid belt. So, asteroid, that was kind of cool. But we've never had anything as close up as that for an asteroid. And the albedo, compared with Halley, the albedo is about 20%. It's a kind of gray channel. It's you're seeing pretty much the real color right there.
What's the moon? Our moon? What's the albedo?
That is, so zero is completely pitch black.
What is our moon?
100% is completely white.
What our moon, though? What's the albedo of our moon? Moon.
Oh, the moon is, what is the moon?
5 to 10%. Depends on the islands or the
Mario. Yeah, the moon's pretty dingy. But, similar. Earth is really bright, as you might expect. And when you look at the Earth and the Moon in the same image, the Moon looks really dingy. Okay, so there it is, Gasper. We got that. That's kind of how we did. So I'll just give you the teams that I was using last year for the fourth decade, and then we'll be done and say we can talk about questions and look at ICE decade, 1992 to 2001, we started getting the increase in camera quality goes way up, and we start getting images of Venus. So the United States launched a mission to Venus that was a radar, so a synthetic aperture radar. They used to, it was interesting. It's the first time we ever did a mission that had only one instrument. So not only that, the instrument was also the high-gain antenna. So the high-gain antenna to talk and send data to Earth and get instructions from Earth is also the radar antenna to do the. So they want to cut through the really thick, dense clouds of Venus and get basically use radar like they expect. And we got all kinds of amazing things. So we won't talk about that at this talk tonight, but there's all kinds of pillow volcanoes and crazy stuff. So that's called Magellan. That happened in the fourth decade. And then we got lots of Mars stuff started happening, all the rovers started happening. So starting with this little baby rover called Sojourner, and now we've got great big plutonium fueled rovers. This is the solar one, obviously, but now we've got the big plutonium ones. It's more of a route of plutonium we're using it for the rovers. We've got, there's a rover on Mars right now, Perseverance, that's like in the middle of the table to here. It's the size of a, like a Cooper, like a small car. It's crazy. And next time I come, I guess I'll show you the, but to land it, they use something called a sky crane. And then drop it and have it balance and all that. The balloons get crazy. That'll work. So that's what's going on right now. So, all right, I guess that's it. That will be it. Last year, on October 20th, we had a, and I guess that's about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
About 3 weeks from now, so about 3 weeks ahead of schedule. So we were making a plug. The Louisville Astronomical Society came that night and set up their telescopes in the parking lot of the library. All right, thank you very much.